Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Simon Lambert. And coming up, the UK stock market looks cheaper than ever. Is it finally time to buy British? We reveal exactly how much money you should have in your savings based on your age. NS&I launches new fixed savings bonds, but how do the rates compare? Savings apps are incredibly popular, but how safe is your cash? And my neighbour broke my lawnmower. Can I make him pay for the repair? Don't forget to update with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the US stock market has reigned supreme for, well, some time now, hitting anyone who favoured British funds and shares in recent years. The government is desperate to get us to buy British. We've been asking for years if this is finally the time that we do so. But could Trump's tariff turmoil mean that this really genuinely is the year to buy British? Well, that's the question that Fidelity's Andrew Oxlade and former member of the This Is Money Parish has been answering. Simon, welcome. What has he been saying?
Thanks, Georgie. So this relates to a number of things. And I think the biggest thing in everyone's mind still is tariffs. The tariff madness started about 2 weeks ago now, really stepped up a gear over the week before this one, and has then sort of seen a little bit of an easing back this week. Stock markets are still pretty volatile. Everyone's still wondering what's going on, but we are in the early days of Donald Trump's 90-day pause, although there are now rumblings about extra tariffs on drug firms and things like that. And it's a story that's going to rumble on. What's happened here is that it's taken a bit of the shine off that high-flying US stock market that so much money has been lumped into in recent years. And to put that in context, even after the recent fall, which for the S&P has been around about a kind of correction of about 10%, it's actually still up 5% over the last year. So the market hasn't even fallen back to where it was a year ago. That's after some of the rebound that we've seen in the past week. But over 5 years, it's up 84%, which is pretty impressive. But that has come with the arrival of Magnificent Seven stocks, which take up a huge chunk of that US index. And the US index has become increasingly dominant in the global stock market as a point of that. And to just draw a little bit of contrast here, Apple, as a company, based on its stock market valuation, is pretty much the same size as the entire UK stock market. That's really quite incredible. And when you think about, well, what happens if some of those people who are invested in Apple say, do you know what? Actually, I don't think Apple's prospects look quite as rosy as we previously thought Apple's prospects look due to the problems with the tariffs. Okay, it's going to cause a slowdown in global trade. It's eroded some of the trust that is so important to trade. If me and you do business, I need to believe that, you know, if you want to buy something off me, I need to believe that you're going to pay me, and you need to believe that I'm going to sell it to you and give it to you when I meant to, and then we're not going to try and rook each other halfway through the transaction. And what Donald Trump has done on a grand global scale is create a scenario where people think they might be rooked halfway through the transaction, or they can't quite trust what's going to go on in the future. And the effect that that has is it dampens the appetite for doing business. People are a bit more reticent, a bit less likely to do business. Now, that's fine if you're Donald Trump, the businessman. Donald Trump, the New York property magnate and man who licenses his name to people's buildings and people's developments and things like that, because people can choose to do business with you or people can choose not to do business with you. And there were many people who did business with Donald Trump, But there were also many people who probably chose not to do business with Donald Trump because they didn't want to. When someone is the president of the United States of America, it becomes a lot harder to choose not to do business with them. But on a grand global scale, that's sort of the decision that's going on here. People are feeling forced to do business with him. If you look at the, you know, the countries falling over themselves to like kind of negotiate the tariffs, companies offering to reshore, Nvidia, big announcement, they're going to spend $500 billion. Apple are going to spend $500 billion as well. All this kind of stuff that's going on. Now, you'd look at that as an investor and you go, okay, well, maybe these companies, the Nvidias, the Apples, the Teslas, et cetera, of the world that we've plowed so much money into, don't quite look as attractive as they thought they might be. But I still want to invest my money. Where else could I invest my money? I might invest it in something that looks a bit cheaper. Georgie's waving her hands here.
I'm
yay,
waving
she's
going,
like,
over
she's
here,
like,
over
I'm the
here.
UK stock market. Hey guys, I'm the UK stock market. Party over here. That's what's going on. Investors are looking at this and going, okay, where else do I put my money? They could put their money in the safe haven of bonds, although bonds proved to not be such a safe haven over the last couple of weeks when as they what should have happened is that bonds yields should have gone down and prices should have gone up, and instead prices went down and yields went up. So they didn't provide the traditional safe haven asset they would do. They could put some money in gold. Gold has been going up lots, but they're also going to look at other stock markets. And where are they going to look? They're going to look at maybe ones that aren't quite so high flying and unloved. They're going to look for a bit of a bargain. They're going to look for somewhere where there isn't that kind of price for perfection element. And Andrew says, they're going to look at the UK. They're going to look at the UK stock market. They're also going to look at Europe. And they are looking at Europe at the moment, because what they're seeing is potentially an alternative, a developed world alternative run by democratic governments, in the same way that the US is also run by a democratic government. Let's not forget that, you know, it is a democracy. But they're looking at these countries and going, okay, well, they just look a lot more stable. They just at the moment look a bit less likely to do some crazy stuff. And I believe that when I agree to do business with them, the terms are not going to change halfway through in the same way that they might possibly change or the goalposts move or something like that with the US at the moment. And that's not to say that everyone's suddenly going to rush out of the US stock market and into the UK or rush out of the US stock market and into Europe. But going back to that point I made about the size of Apple, is like if only just a small amount of that money moves out of Apple and moves into the UK, that has the power to seriously move the UK stock market. If only a small amount of money moves out of the Magnificent Seven and moves into the UK or Europe, that could create a serious tailwind for the shares of the companies that trade on those markets.
It's interesting you said about developed, because obviously you would think of UK and Europe, but I did a interview recently with someone from the Global South, and obviously they're jostling for position there to take a big cut of some of that money. Why would they necessarily be looking to UK or Europe? If you're going to keep a fair amount of your money probably in the US, would you necessarily look to the UK or Europe or perhaps further afield?
Well, that's a really good question, and the one that any investors looking at how to play this in the future should think. Because what you need to be avoiding doing is making any knee-jerk reactions. The worst thing anybody could have done last week is suddenly turn their entire portfolio upside down, because they might have found it that they missed out on the rebound. You know, you could have done it the day before the S&P bounced 9.5%, and then you just moved into something that didn't go up by as much, and you were like, drat, I've cost myself even more money. The time to have moved your portfolio around was before all of this madness kicked off. Once the madness has kicked off and you're right in the middle of the storm, you want to be careful about making any drastic changes. But investment is a long-term game. You should hold your investments for at least 5 years minimum. You should be thinking in that time frame. But if things change, you should potentially relook at those investments. And so to go back to your point, if people are relooking at their investments, then yeah, they might look at the UK, they might look at Europe, they might look at emerging markets, they might look at some of those other countries. But the thing to remember, I think, is that people are looking at them in terms of risk as well. Why are they moving their money? They're moving their money because they see the US as more uncertain and potentially more high risk. Where are they going to want to move that money to? At times of uncertainty, people tend to become more cautious. Are they going to move it into something that is seen as also high risk? I mean, you could in a portfolio
depends on your
building
long-term outlook though, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, in a portfolio building sense, Depending on your outlook, you could look at emerging markets as equally risky or more risky than the US, even with the tariff situation, and potentially more likely to be damaged by the tariffs. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's large board and the numbers on it, there were some countries in there where people were like, what? Huh? I mean, so for
Oh
example, to take, the remarkable turnaround in the tariff soap opera, we've got Vietnam that gets absolutely hammered with the board and the tariffs, and then all of a sudden America is negotiating with Vietnam, and Vietnam looks like it might come out of this quite well. And at Vietnam, theoretically, you would look at it and go, actually, Vietnam could be a benefit of a trade war between the US and China, because if there's going to be less stuff made in China, well, let's remember this stuff is being made in China because it's cheaper to make it in China and then sell it into the US. And there may be some reasons why there is a very unlevel playing field there. And it is possible to be wrong and right at the same time. Donald Trump is wrong about many, many, many things, but there is a bit of him that is right about some of this China stuff. But, Vietnam should benefit from it. But then all of a sudden you look at the board and it's like, oh no, Vietnam's getting
Okay.
hit even harder. And then 4 days later, oh, actually, Vietnam's going to do all right. Vietnam's doing that thing you just did, waving his hand. Hey, look at us over here, Vietnam, party in Vietnam. Whereas if you look at the UK or Europe, there is the stability, they're a bit less exposed to it. And if so, I think that maybe both of those things could benefit. It's not to say they wouldn't. I mean, also the other one to mention is Japan. Japan is again a stock market that is considered to be cheap. It is a very much a developed country with a lot of very well-developed companies within it. And that could benefit. But also Asia, in the sense of like, we're not talking about teeny tiny companies here. There are Asian tech stars. There are companies doing amazing stuff with AI in Asia, and they are trading at valuations that are half or a third of the same companies that are doing similar things in the US.
So, what in sum did Andrew say as to where to go next? What's he going to look at? But he's been quite heavily British, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. And I could reflect similarly on my own portfolio. It has been more skewed towards Britain than the global market would
That's quite
include
typical, though, isn't
Britain.
it?
That
You're
is very
more home
typical
bias, aren't you?
home
Yeah.
bias. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are totally overexposed to Britain, because it depends what companies you're invested in. Because if you're invested in some of those FTSE giants that are effectively large global businesses, then you're exposed to the world. But if you're invested in more domestically focused FTSE companies, maybe some of the stuff in the FTSE 250 or smaller companies, then you are much more exposed to the UK. But that hasn't paid off for people due to the stratospheric rises in US share prices. The best thing people could have done is just invested in a cheap global tracker fund. And that has been dominated by the US, and it's just gone up by lots and lots and lots. But one of the options that Andrew mentions here is dividends, is the yields that you can get on the UK market. So the income from UK shares is at 3.8%. That compares to 1.8% for world stock markets and 1.2% for the US. Now, companies' ability to pay those dividends may be undermined by tariffs. But if the share prices fall, the yields will be pushed up, and you can get in and buy some companies that are yielding very high amounts. I mean, he highlights Britain's biggest listed insurer, Legal & General. Legal & General is a good company. It might not be the world's greatest company, but it's a good company. It's a profitable company. I would argue it's probably not going anywhere. In terms of like, it's not going to vanish. It's not going to shoot the lights out, but it's not going to vanish. But those shares yield 9.8%. There are some other investment companies, Phoenix and M&G. Andrew, when he wrote this, both of those shares yielded more than 10%. Now,
Wow.
you might not get a lot of capital growth out of those companies, but if you get those dividends and you reinvest those dividends over time, then they will pay off. To give an example of this, someone I know quite closely, AKA my wife, used to work for Tesco. And as part of that, she bought Tesco shares. Tesco has always been quite good at doing, share safe schemes and also giving some shares to the people who work there. Unfortunately, she managed to work there and own shares either side of the great Tesco supermarket price scandal crash, etc. So many of those shares she bought, at a kind of option price, a discounted option price that remained for many years at a premium to the actual price of what those shares were worth. So the share prices fell after she bought them, and the shares were underwater. But what she has been doing is reinvesting the dividends over the years. And so even though I think still now, because Tesco shares have fallen quite a bit, unfortunately, this year after having done really, really well last year, even though now I think that still quite a lot of the shares she bought are underwater, actually, the holding is worth way more than she paid for it. And she's in a very healthy profit due to the accumulation of those dividends paid out over years, and then those dividends being reinvested, and then getting paid more dividends on the shares that are being reinvested, and so on. And it's basically the effect of the long-term power of compounding. Also, Andrew has highlighted, the opportunity for infrastructure investments. For example, he's highlighted investment trust, International Public Partnership Investment Trust. It aims to grow its yield each year, currently 6.11%. Makes Fidelity's list of select 50, and that's the kind of thing where you've got a more stable investment where, okay, its value may go up and down, but ultimately we're trying to invest infrastructure in this country, so there should be a bit of a tailwind behind it. And if it can keep doing that with the dividend, and you keep reinvesting it, and it grows, over the course of 10 years, you do pretty well. And you can see that actually, interestingly, in the example of the FTSE. It's a really great example of the power of taking dividends and reinvesting dividends, because on pri in price terms, the FTSE has really disappointed over the last, 10, 20 years. But actually, on total return terms, with those dividends reinvested, it has done much better and hasn't been a bad investment at all.
So in sum, it's not about people leaving the States because of the turmoil there and where can we look? Oh, well, Britain's all right. It looks quite cheap. Let's go there. There are actually fundamentally good reasons why you would look to buy British.
Yeah, fundamentally there are, and that
Not been
story,
cheap because it's been rubbish, basically.
that story hasn't changed. We have a lack of technology companies. We have more what are dubbed to be old world economy companies. But within that, that's not to say technology is always going to win, and a lot of those old world economy style companies are using technology to improve their businesses. Just because they might not be a tech firm doesn't mean that they're not taking advantage of technology. We have been, and all, largely speaking, the European market as well, many markets have been left in the dust by the success of a increasingly concentrated US stock market. But that's not, we've been saying that's not going to continue forever. The question has always been, what's going to be the catalyst that lifts, UK shares? And recently, in recent years, the catalyst that has lifted UK shares has basically been buyouts, other companies coming in from elsewhere and buying up those companies because they think they're too cheap. They think they're a bargain. And there's that whole kind of, if you don't buy them, someone else will. Now, ideally, going back to things we've discussed on the podcast before, we'd see a much more healthy UK stock market where, if companies get bought out, new companies are listing. Rather than it being, companies are bought out and the stock market gets thinner and the stock market gets thinner. Or we'd see people investing because the companies are doing well and they want to be invested in those companies, rather than, those companies being invested in, as a whole by someone else buying it out because the shares are too cheap. But, maybe this turmoil will be the catalyst that makes people look elsewhere other than the US, because there are lots of really great companies in the UK, and there is work going on behind the scenes to try and revive the fortunes of the UK stock market and make it a more attractive place to be.
All right, from investing to savings. Now, if personal finance experts and journalists can all agree on one thing, it's that you need to focus on building up your emergency savings buffer. But a third of all adults have under £1,000 saved. That's according to official statistics. So the proportion with low financial resilience is almost twice as high for those in their 20s and 30s. So, how much do you need to have saved, depending on how old you are? But before we get to that, I thought the general accepted amount was 3 to 6 months of essential outgoings. Isn't that what all the experts say? So should that really matter your age? Where does that come from?
It comes from just a sort of general rule of thumb, really, and it means that it's not accurate for everyone. It will be different for different people. It depends on what you have to fall back on, and But it's a good rule of thumb, right? Because it means that you should be covered. But then when you look at those figures that you just read out and the amount of savings that people have, and you look at some of the stuff we talked about late last year when there was talk about ideas to get more financial resilience by getting people to not just save for workplace pensions, but to save for workplace rainy day funds as well. It is astonishing the number of people in this country who don't have much in the way of savings. And I actually think it's like quite an interesting generational problem personally, because I think you're always going to have people who are struggling to get by and struggle to save. And everything we can possibly do to help those people build up a buffer. I think one of those financial resilience surveys that we covered and reports said that even if people just had £1,000, the chances of them then falling into serious financial difficulty in the future were drastically slashed. It was like it was made a massive difference to, like, if just one thing went wrong, whether they would end up potentially in a kind of debt spiral or not. You know, those who are really struggling are always going to struggle to get by. But I think there's also a scenario where people in their 30s, 40s are never going to save as much as their parents' generation did. If you look at the, you know, some of the statistics, and also when we do polls on the site and things like that, and, you know, and just like anecdotal evidence I know from parents' friends, all that kind of stuff, that generation managed to build up really quite healthy savings and investment pots, you know, outside of their pensions, because a lot of people benefited from, you know, the workplace final salary pension and so on, in a way that I just don't see our generation being able to, due to the much higher cost of mortgages, for example, you know, the high cost of living, the tax situation. We talked about this a few weeks ago. If the higher rate tax threshold had risen with inflation since 1997, it would be at £74,000. The higher rate tax threshold is actually at £50,000. The difference on that amount is about kind of £4,000 a year, £5,000 a year for someone. If they actually had that money in their pocket instead, they might spend it, but they also might save it. And if they saved it and they did that over a few years, they'd build up, you know, they'd start to build up that much healthier savings pot. So I think, you know, there is an interesting thing going on there. But to go back to the rainy day fund stuff, it's basically, you know, covering you if you lose your job, you fall ill and you can't work or things like that. And people are underinsured in that scenario. Financial advisors will tell you that you really need to consider some form of income protection insurance, but most people don't have it. And, you know,
no, I went to a financial planner once and they looked at everything, said, yeah, you know, tick, 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 your big gap is some sort of income protection. I think that's quite a common thing.
It is, because it looks expensive when people look at it. They're like, that's really expensive. And that's going to cost me a fortune. I can't afford to pay that. I think what also people need to consider is that safety net, what they have to fall back on. So, I mean, do you have income protection insurance? If you've got income protection insurance, you probably afford to have a bit less in your rainy day fund. How long is your notice period at work? Are you on 1 month? I mean, well, are you self-employed for a start?
Yeah, zero.
how guaranteed is your income, right? Because if you're employed, you get paid your salary every month, right? Unless you lose your job. If you're self-employed, that income's not guaranteed in the same way. So you need a bigger buffer to allow for the months where you don't have so much coming in, and you've still got to pay those bills. But going back to, if you're employed, you know, are you on 1 month's notice, 3 months' notice, 6 months' notice? Because, you know, if you're on 6 months' notice, then you can probably get away with having a considerably smaller rainy day fund than that 3 to 6 months of your income, because, you know that unless you're, you know, sacked for gross misconduct or something, which I would recommend not happening, you get your notice period paid out, and that gives you three months worth of leeway is worth, you know, it's worth a lot, that is, versus one month worth of leeway is not so much. Or some people might be working in the kind of 0 hours scenario where they have no leeway whatsoever. They could just be got rid of. So you need to think about that. But yeah, you need to look at your essential outgoings. So you can take off some of the discretionary spending. You know, you can always dial that stuff back, but you can't dial back your energy bills, your mortgage, your rent, and so on. So what Lucy Evans did here in this article is she looked at basically average annual earnings at that age and outgoings, and then looked at what that kind of 3 month buffer would look at, rather than just looking at the earnings. So if you're 18 to 21, Average annual earnings after tax are just £13,750, and outgoings are typically £13,507, which leaves those people around £243 a year that they could potentially save. So it's going to take a long time to build up the emergency savings pot. A 3 month buffer would be £3,400. 6 months would be £6,700. Going to take you a long time to save that up. But if you're 18 to 21, you might have a bit more of a net to fall back on. You might be in the position that not everybody is in, but lots of people are in, where they could potentially fall back on their parents a bit. They could fall back on their family. You might be living at home. Might not have total kind of independence. And that will help you out in that way. 22 to 29, earnings on average increase to £24,900 a year. Outgoings are typically £24,239. That means you're going to need about £6,000 to £12,000 in your cash buffer. And many of these people are going to be trying to pay rent at the same time, save for a home deposit. Very difficult to do. Also, potentially more likely to be in those jobs where they have shorter notice periods because they're earlier in their career, temporary jobs, making career switches. So a cash buffer is important here and trying to build it up. 30 to 39, salaries start to increase. You need between about £7,000 and £15,000 stashed away. You might also be in a relationship living with someone else. Now, that's where that helps out because chances are, and you should always work on the basis that the worst case scenario could happen, but chances are you're probably not going to both lose your job at exactly the same time. So, could you rely on the other person a bit? Could you rely on the other person's income? Could you rely on the other person's savings? But also, you might start to have children as well. And then the expenses and the things that you need to provide for go up, as does the prospect of more rent or more mortgage and so on. 40 to 49, this is the decade your salary typically peaks in, at an average of £43,500. So those in their 40s spend the most out of all the age groups, £31,000 a year, basically. It gives them obviously much more opportunity for saving money because there's a bigger gap between those two numbers, but they're going to need a buffer of about 7,700 to 15,500 saved. And also, they're going to have probably more dependents on them in case stuff does go wrong. 50 to 59, salaries fall slightly, £42,000 on average. Spending falls slightly too. Again, similar cash buffer. 60 plus, spending tends to drop at this age. The average worker aged over 60 earns £33,000 a year and spends £25,600 of it. But they might be in the final years of trying to save into their pension. So that's an important thing to consider. And then in retirement, your income has probably dropped. The average post-tax pension income is £19,500. But your incomings will probably have gone down as well. But you might actually need a bigger cash pot because if you're relying on an invested pension to provide you with an income, you probably need to have more cash to deal with scenarios like we've had recently where the markets have fallen and you want to be trying to avoid taking money out of your investments while they are trading at a lower level.
Hearing you talk about the 18 to 21 year olds made me think. And so I was just looking at the Hargreaves Lansdown, there are plenty of others, investment calculator, just thinking if you just put as a parent £10 a month aside for 18 years, growth rate 5%, it says here, you've got £3,500 by the time they're 18, which it's not too bad. I mean, you could probably put more than £10, but I thought I'd start really, really quite low. That's just a nice, secure little buffer for, yeah. Young one, your 18-year-old, you know, to go into life and just hold it there.
That's a really good idea. And that's the kind of thing that we should be teaching parents and new parents in a financial sense of like, okay, what could you do to help your child out? Because people think, oh, house deposit. And then they look at it and go, oh my God, how would I ever help them with a house deposit? Going back to the conversation we had about how much harder it is potentially for people to save nowadays. But, a little often and the power of compounding will make a big difference. But don't only think in the prospects of house deposit. People also think about university fees, but there's quite a lot of debate as to whether you should help your child with university fees or not, or whether you should just, allow them to go into a system that certainly seems quite unfair, but then at least means they're part of the herd. And then if somebody ever does something about that unfair system, they might benefit from it. Or at least they won't be in a worse position than most of their peers. Or maybe they don't want to go to university. Maybe that's the other option. Maybe you go to university later in life when you've got built up a bit of money that can help you to pay for it or so on. But yeah, I think thinking about, can you seed some money for an emergency fund? And then when you give that money to them, can you try to make sure that it remains an emergency fund? Because there's always that problem, isn't there, with like giving people money, that will they just spend it? So can you just create enough of a hurdle in the way that prevents them from spending it? So for example, I would say this is where something like premium bonds pays off, or a fixed rate savings account, or even investing the money for them in an account. You open the account with them and then you invest the money, because it's just that bit harder to get your hands on the money and spend it than it is if it's just sitting in a savings account that you can just take it out of.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now for our weekly Investing Explained feature by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct. Rob, we've got a question here from a listener. I'd like to invest some money in a gold ETF. What is a sensible portion of an investment portfolio to put in it?
Thanks, Simon. That's a really hard question, actually, because although gold is often labeled a safe haven asset, that's not always the case in the short or medium term, and we need to consider the pros and cons of owning it in a portfolio. So it's true that gold can be a sort of financial teddy bear that investors cling to in times of crisis. And when the world seems uncertain, the timeless and permanent nature of gold takes on a greater appeal. After all, for much of human history, it's been used as a store of value and a display of wealth. And gold also has a special status as a hedge against inflation. Unlike paper currencies, so pounds, dollars, euros, and so on, they get devalued over the years. Gold supply is finite, and when measured in decades, gold has done a really good job of keeping up with rising prices. So you can think of it as kind of an ultimate long-standing world currency. And gold tends to do its own thing in relation to other assets, such as shares and bonds, and that makes it potentially useful as a diversifier in a portfolio where you want different investments performing at different times to help out. Even out the peaks and the troughs. So, although there's some good reasons for investors to be attracted to gold, there's also some key drawbacks that can make it a frustrating asset to own. So, in the short term, the price can be really unpredictable, very volatile, driven by fast-changing investor sentiment. So, while it's considered a safe haven asset in the context of preserving spending power over decades, it can be anything but in the short term. In any given week, month, or year, it can fall quite heavily. It's also worth noting that it isn't a productive asset, so it has no earnings or income that can grow or indeed be measured. So while it can be expected to broadly keep up with inflation over time, there isn't necessarily any reason to think that it should beat inflation substantially. So at times it can be a bit of a dead weight in a portfolio, particularly during periods of stability and growth. So given these characteristics, I think it's worth considering a bit of gold exposure as an asset with a long-term wealth preservation characteristics, but I would say keep that exposure pretty limited, possibly to about 5 or 10% of a portfolio, so that if it does have an extended period in the wilderness, it won't derail your portfolio too much. It is also best practice to rebalance that exposure. In other words, top up when it falls and trim when it rises to keep the intended weight intact and help naturally take any outsized profits when they occur.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Talking of savings, indeed, talking of premium bonds, as Simon was just before the break there, National Savings and Investments of Premium Bonds fame has launched a range of savings bonds for those wanting to lock their money away for a better return. But how, Simon Lambert, do they compare with what's already out there? So, what has the nation's favourite savings provider launched?
Well, this is interesting. It's been 15 years since 1, 2, 3, and 5 year fixed rate savings accounts have been available with NS&I at the same time. And this comes after discussions around how the NS&I might be raising more money came out of the spring statement following the budget and so on. So it's launched new issues of its guaranteed growth bonds, guaranteed income bonds, collectively known as British savings bonds. The new interest rate on the 5 year growth option is 4.06%. That's not bad. 5 years, 4% on your money for 5 years, risk-free money, basically backed by the government. That's a solid return. Now, you might think if you're going to put your money away for 5 years, perhaps you should invest it instead. And you would hope over 5 years to get a better return than that. But a reasonable expected return might be 6%. So actually banking a bit of money that's earning at 4% is pretty good. The 2 and 3 year versions of the bonds are at 4% and 4.1% respectively. And then the 1% is at 4.05% for the growth and income options. So they're all roughly at the same level, but the choice is how long do I stick my money away from and bank this 4% a year? But I think this is one of those examples where people need to think about their money and their savings in the form of like different pots or different chunks rather than as a whole. Now, arguably, if you've got a big pot, then you shouldn't just lock that whole pot away in the 5 year option at 4.06%. Maybe you should leave your options open. You could always do a ladder where you put some of it in a one, some of it in a two, some of it in three, some of it in a five. Or you could do a situation where you take some of your pot, 10%, 20% of it, and you stick it in the 5 year option and go, right, that's my bit there. And then you take another bit and you put it in the 1 year option or choose the best, 1 year fixed rate that you can get on the market. And then you take some of the rest of it and you invest it and go, okay, hopefully I can get a better return from it. But then if things go bad and the markets don't do well over the next 5 years, at least I've got that guaranteed bit of income coming in from elsewhere.
So what do you think, Simon? Will these be popular?
I would imagine they'll be very popular. Yeah. I mean, they're
Just because of
competing
NSNI or because you...
because it's NS&I, because they're competing with the savings rates near the top of the tables. They're not at the top of the tables, but they're competing near the top of the tables. Anything NS&I does. And also going back to the point that we made earlier about, that kind of concern, safety, risk, people being worried at the moment, people see it as a safer option. But I mean, I would go and look at the savings tables, go to thisismoney.co.uk/save, where you can find our best fixed rate savings tables. And at the moment, top deal there, Synergy Bank, 4.6% over 1 year. Over 2 years, you've got Close Brothers, 4.58%. 3 years, Close Brothers again, 4.55%. And 5 years, Secure Trust at 4.58%.
Why is the NS&I why is it so popular? Every time I think about NS&I, obviously you naturally think about premium bonds, and every time I think about premium bonds, I think about Lee Boyce, who, poor guy, hasn't won anything for years. But what is it about NS&I? What are the benefits? Because you have the FSCS protection, don't you, with other institutions? So what is, people say it's safe, but well, isn't anything that's got that protection?
Yes, arguably anything that has FSCS protection up to £85,000 per individual per individually licensed bank is protected. The government stands behind that protection. There is a an official compensation scheme, and in that sense your money is protected. People see NS&I and just as just that bit safer, don't they? I wonder whether there's lots of people who think that they don't have to pay tax on it as well. There might be that thing going on. People just don't quite get their head around some of this stuff. They think, oh, NS&I, that's tax-free. It's not. Premium bonds are. But I don't know. And it is national savings and investments. It's just that kind of security blanket thing. And that's why, obviously, they can get away with offering lower rates than the rest of the market, because they know that, in the grand scheme of things, they will be able to undercut other players and still get money in because people see that. Safety element. It's what Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley referred to in our question this week when talking about gold as like a financial teddy bear, cuddle in times of crisis. I quite like that metaphor. NS&I is our national financial teddy bear.
Nice. Now, you mentioned FSCS protection there. If you, and I'm sure, dear listener, you do keep an eye on the Best Buy Cash ISA tables, you will see most of the top rates at the moment are offered by a new wave of app-based savings providers. Now, these include the likes of Plum, CMC Invest, Moneybox, Trading 212, to name a few, and they offer upwards of 4.9%, though some on offer are bonus rates, which we know that Lee Boyce loves. But if you want to know more about that, go back a couple of episodes. But how safe is your cash with these apps? Now, I know these more, most of these here, more as investing apps, but of course they do offer savings products as well. I mean, we're going from the sublime to the ridiculous. We're going from NS&I to these apps. This is real next generation stuff.
Yeah, And you should be asking yourself that question. It's the first question you should be asking yourself before you put your money into anything, particularly if it's savings, is how safe is this and what backs that up? Now, we as a principle only cover savings accounts, and this is money in our savings tables, that have FSCS protection up to £85,000 per individual, per individually licensed bank. So what you need to watch out for is, do you as an individual have more than £85,000 in? You could double that for a joint account. We're talking about cash ISAs here, so you obviously can't get a joint cash ISA. And where is that protection provided by? Because these savings apps, investment apps, are not necessarily the actual custodians of your savings. The money is held with other banks and the protection is provided with other banks. And so the underlying protection might be provided by someone like Barclays, JP Morgan. So hang on a minute. Have I got money in Barclays? Have I got money in JP Morgan, like with a Chase account or something like that, that would take me over the £85,000? This used to be something you used to have to watch out for with different brands that were operated by the same bank. The classic being anything connected to Halifax, Bank of Scotland, in the old days, which is now known as Lloyds Banking Group, which, you know, after the financial crisis merger included Halifax, Bank of Scotland, Lloyds Banking Group, numerous other brands. You had to watch out for it with Santander, which also had some other brands under its name, and, you know, various other banks. You had to go, okay, hang on a minute, you know, what's going on here? Now what you need to do is you need to look at this and say, okay, look through the small print. It's not very difficult to find. It's quite obvious. They make it obvious. What's the underlying protection coming from? And am I over the £85,000? Because you could consider it a more risky proposition that one of these companies, you know, may end up in trouble than a big bank. I mean, history would tell you that those big banks could also end up in financial trouble, as they did, which is why the whole thing of savings compensation came to the fore, and why people first started talking about licenses, and why at one point, as I cast my memory back to 2009, the regularly most read page on This Is Money was our list of banks and where their banking license was held, and therefore which ones had savings compensation that overlapped. The heady, heady days of that conviction that banks could just drop like dominoes at any point. But to go back to these savings apps, we have been covering this rate battle in detail. The rate battle is driving us absolutely nuts. There are occasions where we have been writing stories and editing stories, and the rates have changed multiple times as we are doing them. On the Friday before the end of the tax year, I think that happened 6 times in the process of the final story we were doing at 5 p.m. 5 p.m. on a Friday at the end of the tax year. Not cool. Not cool. But we got the story out there. We got the savings alert out there. We told readers about the deals. But what we also told them about was the rates that they would drop to. Because as we talked about a couple of podcasts past, this has all been reliant on these 3-month bonuses. Now, I don't understand, and I wrote about this this week, why they are allowed to claim this as an AER, annual equivalent rate, when the rate is guaranteed to not be that rate for a year because it's going to drop after 3 months.
We've asked that.
No, we tried the FCA. They sent us back a kind of like, just like, you know, pat, you know, answer from something. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe when all banks start doing this, right, in a year's time, the FCA will announce an investigation or something. But in the meantime, this seems to be being allowed to go on. It's because they're variable rates, basically, that they can get away with it, because it's AER variable. So it's like it could change anyway. I mean, it's going to change anyway. If interest rates come down, the rate's going to change anyway, you know. But what you need to look at is you need to look at the headline rate, you need to look at the underlying rate, you need to look at the gap between them, because the gap between them is really important, because some of these, the gap between them is relatively narrow. So, for example, Trading 212 unfortunately cut its underlying rate from 4.5% to 4.35% today. But like up until now, it'd been 4.5%. The boosted rate is 5.04. That's actually a better deal because those two are much closer together than Plum's Easy Access ISA, which has a 2.14% gap between the two, because that's got 5.68% to 3.54%. Plum will also only allow you to make 3 withdrawals. Trading 212 will allow you to make unlimited withdrawals and is a flexible ISA. it's the better deal. The actual real best deal at the moment, though, is CMC Invest. It's got a 0.85% bonus for 3 months at the time of recording this. This might have changed by the time I've finished my sentence.
Probably.
possibly changed by the time you're listening to this podcast. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/save to find what's going on with rates and the latest updates, because we've made a rod for our own back by committing to update them when they change, and so are sometimes doing this about 15 times a day. But at the moment, 5.7%, 0.85% bonus, 4.85% underlying rate. That's the real best deal. But when we write about these, we get comments from readers saying, risky, these apps, don't think I put my money in them. You know, what if it goes bust? Da, 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 da. We've covered that in the article. In the article, we've said they're protected by the FSCS compensation scheme.
Yeah.
You know, understand how it works. But that's what you need to look out for. And actually, I would say do not discount these savings apps because they're not well-known banks or building societies, or because they're doing this three-month bonus trick, because these are genuinely the best cash ISAs that you can get at the moment, right? The big banks and building societies are not offering the best cash ISAs at the moment. Some of these are really good. The two that stand out at the moment are CMC Invest and Trading 212, because as I said, you know, the rate thing, they've got no limits on withdrawals, they're genuine easy access accounts, and they're flexible. You take money out, put it back in within the same tax year, doesn't use any of your ISA allowance. For many people, that doesn't matter, but it's the thing that stops people using their ISA, like taking money in and out, so they end up paying tax on their savings instead. And if you are a higher rate taxpayer and only get £500 of interest tax for each year, or an additional rate taxpayer and get no interest tax for each year, then a flexible ISA is an essential tool in your financial toolbox.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Yeah, good one, Simon. Right, finally, reader question time. One for consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. We do love a neighbourly reader question. My next door neighbour borrowed my lawnmower and broke it. He says the mower was old and it wasn't his fault. I want him to pay for its repair. What are my rights? Before you give me Dean's answer, I'm going to give you mine, which is my philosophy about lending anything to anyone, particularly money to family and friends. Assume it's not coming back. That's just my answer. I'm sure there's a legal element to this, but I just feel that that's sort of a good way to be about life, you know?
But how would you deal with a scenario where your friend or neighbour really needs a lawnmower and they know you've got a lawnmower and you're saying, you can't have it? What do you say? Do you just say to them, look, I'm sorry, basically, I just don't trust that you'll either give it back to me or not break it? Or do you go, oh, actually, I don't have a lawnmower?
I mean, the reality is I'm not really a stuff person. So I think I would always give my lawnmower to someone if they asked. And then if they broke it, I'd just pay for it. But if it was something I really didn't want to give them, or in the case of this lawnmower, I might lie, actually, Simon, if I'm really honest. I might say, do you know what? I think there's a few problems with its electrics and I just wouldn't feel comfortable you having it. That's what I'd say. Oh, I'm an awful person. But I would make something like that up and, you know, it's not you, I just...
The classic, it could explode at any time.
Yeah, kind of I just excuse. Couldn't live with myself if something bad happened to you. But I'm okay using it.
You get a knock on the door, your neighbour's there. They're like, oh, I'm making carbonara. But I don't have a cheese grater. Can I borrow you a cheese grater, please? And you say, I'm sorry, it could explode at any time.
I've cut myself so many times. There's something wrong with it. That's what I would say. Oh, my God, I'm an awful liar, aren't I, Simon? It just rolls off the tongue.
I tell you why you're an awful liar as well is because you're also a broadcaster and you're on a podcast that's got, like, quite a lot of listeners and you've just told everyone.
What I say, I know. So if any of my neighbours are listening and they want to borrow anything... And I come out with, no, you can't. The electrics are broken. They'll go, don't believe you.
I actually have a health hazard lawnmower that I probably wouldn't lend to someone.
Right, exactly.
But ours was given to us by my father-in-law, and it's ancient. You know, when you start it up, you have to rely on the choke for quite a while. It belches out quite a lot of smoke. It's kind of, he said we should get it serviced. I was like... Yeah, I mean, we should do, but, like, you gave it to the free and I'm just going to run it into the ground. And then he said, actually, don't get it serviced because, like, the casing's a bit cracked. And he's like, they might condemn it and tell you you can't use it anymore. And I was like, well, they can't stop me using it. But maybe I am going to get it serviced now. But anyway, yeah, we've got a health hazard lawnmower that I probably wouldn't lend to a neighbour because it could explode at any time.
Right. So there you go. You can have that one for free, everybody else who has a perfectly good working. But what did our dean say?
What you mean we're going to do the what the consumer
the official,
rights,
the official
what the consumer
legal
rights lawyer says bit here, rather than what the two idiots on the internet think.
How we would lie to our neighbours.
So
yeah.
Dean Dunham says, under English law, when you borrow goods, you generally have four basic obligations to the lender. One, you must take reasonable care of the borrowed goods. This means using them in a way that avoids damage and returning them in the same condition that you received the goods, except for normal wear and tear. Two, if the goods are damaged while in your possession, you are typically responsible for repairing or replacing them, unless, however, the damage was due to factors beyond your control. Three, you must return the goods at the agreed time. If no specific time was agreed upon, you should return them within a reasonable period. And four, you must only use the goods for their intended purpose and not misuse them. So the legal answer to your question is that if you can prove the damage was not as a result of general wear and tear, you will be entitled to demand that the repair costs be paid. The age and condition of the mower will be a big factor with this, as it will be harder to prove your neighbour was to blame if it is indeed old or worn out. I would find it almost impossible to prove that my neighbour had harmed my lawnmower because it's so shonky. Yeah. Dean, however, says, however, here we are talking about a dispute with your neighbour, so a much more cautious and light approach should be taken. I always advise you try to resolve an issue with neighbours amicably by discussing the problem and trying to reach a consensus. If this does not work, you could look to see if your home insurance policy will cover the cost of the repair. If all else fails, you could take the matter to the small claims court, but this is the absolute last resort and is a course of action that I would not advise in your circumstances. And I would certainly not advise that, because otherwise you might find yourself, instead of asking a question to a newspaper about how to get your lawnmower fixed, as the subject of a story in the newspaper about the being the person who spent £70,000 taking your neighbour to court over your lawnmower.
Yeah, quite. It's just not worth it, is it? Do you know, I have actually remembered where my lawnmower is, but this is quite pertinent because it's in the shed. Unfortunately, we've lost the key to the shed. So I might actually be the person who needs to borrow a lawnmower. Unfortunately, one next door neighbour has AstroTurf, which I'm quite tempted for AstroTurf. You can't be bothered with the rest. And the other one gets a gardener in. So I'm stuck either way.
Listener, if you're buying this nonsense, if you're buying this backtracking where she's coming up with like this excuse in advance.
It's locked
when her
in
neighbor
the
comes around and I'm sorry, the shed's locked. I can't find the key.
We do it at night when everybody's asleep, so no one will know we've got one.
If you're buying this nonsense, then honestly.
I've got a whole book of them, Simon. Right, Simon's stat of the week.
Right, my stat of the week is related to a common theme on this podcast and a common moan of mine. Potholes. You can tell a lot about a country by the state of its roads. Yeah. And our roads do not tell a good story about Britain. Our absolute woeful failure to fix the holes in our roads where they are falling apart and are a health hazard. Not just a hazard to motorists, they are a hazard to pedestrians, they are a hazard to cyclists and all those other things. Not just from like the holes themselves, but from swerving around the holes. It's also symptomatic of the fact that we basically allow private companies to dig up our roads for utilities and then not fix them properly. And that means that basically the private company just gets to make a bit more money, pay out a bit more money to shareholders, and we, the public, lose out. And our roads are a national disgrace. Often it gets claimed that it's to do with extreme weather. Anyone who's ever been to most other countries in the world will realise that they tend to have more extreme weather than we do, and yet their roads are much better. I just went to the Alps last week. The roads were much better in the Alps. And I can tell you that it's definitely colder in winter, with more snow and warmer in the summer in the Alps than it is here. However, there has been some research done into this, and a Freedom of Information request submitted by Citroen to 284 councils across England, Scotland and Wales suggests that if all councils paid the lowest amount recorded for a single planned pothole fix, there could have been 33.3 million fewer potholes. But the report found because councils have significantly different processes and therefore costs for reactive and planned pothole repairs, just 1.89 million were filled throughout 2024. So basically what this comes down to is if they just all used the same method for fixing them and fix them properly, then we could actually fix, apparently, $33 million more a year.
Wow, that is a lot. Right, on that bombshell, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and send us your questions. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.